Hi everybody, my name is Merv Lingle and I am an alcoholic. Sobriety date, June 1st, 2001. I have a home group, it's a Common Solution meeting, group, and we meet Thursday nights at 7:30 at the Hinton Avenue Methodist Church. It's fun stuff, bunch of guys, we're a new group, we've only been around for 5 years, still grown, but it's a lot of fun, and there's a lot of people here who do attend that meeting. And other than that, wow, I really wish I had something, I don't know, you know, back in the day, back like a few years ago, I would come into one of these gigs, and I would have everything so planned out on how, what I was going to talk about, and, you know, where it was going to go, and some big funny things that make everybody laugh, and a big finale, and stuff like this, and you should all be very happy that I have given up on that, and gave up on that about 3 years ago. Sponsor said, you know, you have a good memory of the big book, and, you know, you're intellectually sound, but, you know, and I got where he was talking about, because I was so scared of what people were thinking about me while I would stand up here, that I would present a different personality than what I really was, and it took what it took for me to get through that, and I'm just happy to be here, and I'm definitely happy to be here. You know, I'm not an expert on Alcoholics Anonymous. I think the only thing I'm an expert on is coming up with new innovative ways to be a little less mature than my 7-year-old and try and get away with that, but you know, I'm still growing. I don't practice perfection. I don't preach perfection. I preach and practice growth in the program of Acts of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm definitely glad to be here because I'm one of those people that, you know, I don't know. Well, I feel very fortunate to be here. I still do. By being active in Alcoholics Anonymous and putting my hand out to a bunch of newcomers on a consistent basis and sponsoring guys, you know, it keeps it fresh for me. What it was really like whenever I came into the room of Alcoholics Anonymous. And just tonight, Tim was gracious enough to drive up here with me. And Tim, I used to be his bartender back. I don't know if he was dying from alcoholism from as bad as I was when I was waiting on him, but those were times that I forget about. And then all of a sudden somebody comes across my path and I'm just like, wow, that was a horror show. Fortunately for me, no new amends came up. You know, generally whenever I run into people from my past, you know, or something like that, you know, it's like, oh my God, I owe somebody else money. But this time around, you know, fortunately for me, I paid that restaurant back all the money that I owed them from what I had stolen from them. And, you know, so that was a blessing, you know. So anyways, I don't know, you know, I think the biggest reason that I am here tonight is because I said yes to Alcoholics Anonymous. For years and years and years of, like, I don't know, you know, I mean, the 6 years I spent coming to meetings and not really getting involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, I would come here and I would treat it like a buffet. I'd take what I wanted, but I'd leave what I needed. People would tell me things like, Merv, you need to get a sponsor, you need to get a home group, Merv, you need to take the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and maybe you might get a God of your understanding in your life that might help you stay sober on a consistent basis. And I would hear these things, and I'd just shrug it off, because I still wasn't ready. There's a line in the big book, and it talks about, you know, when and where we will find God. And it's always in the last analysis. In the last analysis, we will find God deep within ourselves. And that's how I found Alcoholics Anonymous. It was the last analysis. See, I would come to you people whenever the heat was on, whenever the wife was going to leave, or whenever the job was in jeopardy, or maybe I was just, you know, it was one DUI too many, and I knew that I would have something wrong with me. I knew that I had a problem drinking alcohol. I knew my relationship with alcohol was not normal. But it would come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and, you know, and for some reason I come into the rooms of AA, and what I would notice right away, because I was identifying out, was simply I'd see these people who had time under their belt, I'd see people who had done the process or the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I would see people laughing and having a good time being sober. And I didn't understand that. You know, because for me, whenever I wasn't drinking, it felt like I was doing time. When I wasn't drinking, the world seemed a little bit heavier. It seemed more like people were out to get me. And I just basically had a problem connecting with other people. I had a problem when I was scared, I would react in anger. I would come out and I would try my best to pretend like I was a part of society, but deep down within myself, I knew that I didn't measure up. I knew I was a loser. I knew I was a thief, and I knew that I would steal from you in a heartbeat to get what I wanted. I knew that I would use you up and then throw you aside like I've done to so many other people in my life. And I knew that that was bound to happen. See, without alcohol as a solution in my life, I suffer from a spiritual illness that likes to show up as depression. It likes to show up as, you know, like I have an anger issue. It likes to show up that I have maybe a little bit of a psychological profile that needs to be investigated by authorities. And that's what I came to you people with. I had a bunch of old ideas of what I was suffering from. You know, because, I mean, I'm sure I sat in a bunch of meetings, and I'm sure I heard the problem told to me, and I'm sure I heard the solution put forth to me in a very coherent, precise manner. But at that point in time, I wasn't ready to listen to it. All I could do was just look at you happy, sober people, and I didn't get it. I thought that there might be something else a little bit different from me. And if you chalk it up, I mean, of course I went to these well-meaning doctors, and I took their exams, and of course I answered all the questions correctly for all kinds of emotional illnesses, for different problems. Heck, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had 5 different diagnoses besides alcoholism. And I thought for sure if I'd be able to manage one of these things correctly, if I just get this emotional problem or this scenarios around me settled down, I would either A, be able to drink like a gentleman, or B, if I got all these other things taken care of, you know what, I wouldn't find it necessary to take a drink to feel like I could be a part of the world again. And it, just like I talked about earlier, it took the last analysis, because I tried all these things. There's a line in the big book that says there's only 2 doors to go through here, and the one is the alcoholic death, and you can do that drinking or not drinking, and the other one is a spiritual way of life. And, you know, and I tried to look for door number 3. Over and over and over again. And there is none. You know, because there was always this time, ever since I was young, I always felt like there was a little bit something missing. Like the day that they told me how to interact with and get along with other people, like I missed that day at school or something. And that's an old analogy, but that's the best one I can come up with. Because, I mean, I'm like the 6-year-old kid trying to punch a hole in a cinder block because I don't understand how to get along with people. I just don't get it. And whenever I get scared, that's my number one reaction, is I get angry. And it's just not mildly angry. It's not passive-aggressive angry. I'm trying to punch a hole in a cinder block. And, you know, and that's just the way that I reacted all my life. And I never got the hint of that. I never knew. I just thought that that's the way everybody was. But I'd watch these people, you know, and they'd all get along well together. And then I would learn over time how to pretend, you know, and just fit in and just put on this nice show for everybody that Merv is calm, Merv's an intelligent guy, I can pretend to get along with other people. But on the inside, I never really felt a part of. And, and that's just the way it was. You know, I do things as a kid. I mean, I wasn't a bad kid, and I wasn't, I wasn't overly smart. I was an average kid. I played baseball. I loved it. I had my parents, the upbringing was a little bit, I don't want to say poor. It was middle class. But my vision of that was we were poor. But now, after taking the steps, I see it through a different filter now, and I see that we were middle class. You know, before I did the steps and I made amends to my parents, I used to think that, my God, they made me this way. They were so awful. But now I see that they were two of the hardest working people on the face of the planet. They loved me more than I could accept. And that's, you know, just what the steps have given me. I used to blame them for everything. I used to blame them for what was wrong with me. And I'll tell you, now I see the truth, is that I suffer from a delusionary mind. I cannot think straight. When I'm in fear, I make up my own reality, and I believe that it is real. And the only thing that's going to help me snap through that is the identification with another alcoholic and taking some few simple required steps of Alcoholics Anonymous that will give me a perception change of not only my present situation, but of my past as well. And that's a really great gift to get. And I hope that if there's anybody new here, that maybe that they might stick around long enough to try the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the 2 things that are great about the steps is that they're simple and you don't have to do them right. And I'm definitely the walking example of that. And you will get a change. And you will get a change. Early on, after I got done and I decided to join Civilization Unlimited by not punching holes in a cinder block wall, my parents. Dad always looked like an alcoholic. Mom was always calling him an alcoholic, and so was everybody else. He was one of those guys that, you know, would take me out to a bar with him. He would stay too late. He'd get drunk. I'd have to call Mom to come pick us up. That would happen occasionally. Dad would get in trouble. Dad would go on the wagon. He would say he was going to stop, but about 2 or 3 weeks later, he would drink again. And he looked just like one of us, by the definition of being an alcoholic, you know, which is, you know, once I start drinking, I don't know how much I'm going to drink or what I'm going to do after I start drinking. And the other one is that I just can't stay stopped. And if you suffer from either one of these, you probably are an alcoholic. So looking at my dad, he looked like an alcoholic. But the day came. The day came with my dad where he had a niece, or no, he had his first grandbaby, and it coincided with them finding a spot on his liver. And my dad stopped drinking. And that was 15 and a half years ago. Did not go to the shrink, didn't go to the church, you know, didn't even come to AA, didn't do anything. He stopped drinking and his life got better. And I kept thinking to myself, you know, all of when I started drinking, especially whenever things started going downhill, you know, in my life, when I just couldn't stay out of trouble anymore, I was thinking, I'd always think to myself, if I got just as bad as my dad, I should be able to quit then. And upon reading the book of Alcoholics Anonymous with a sponsor, once my ears were open, you know, and I was able to, like, basically recollect what reality was a little bit, it told me that there are a couple of different types of drinkers here. And the first one's the one that we all know. The person has a couple of beers and just says, I start to feel it, and they can put it down, and they're fine, you know. And then there's the other one, looks like my dad. And they look a lot like an alcoholic. They're called a heavy drinker. But when the chips come down, they can stop drinking and their life will get better. And I thought that I was that guy. But I'm more of the type of alcoholic that the book describes. And it's called the alcoholic of the hopeless variety. And what that means is it doesn't matter what I pour on my alcoholism, whether it's money, sex, medications. I can pour whatever I want on my alcoholism, and I'm going to do two things. I'm going to continue to drink because I'm powerless over alcohol, and every time that I do drink, I won't be able to control the amount I take. And I really wanted to be my dad, but I wasn't my dad. And like I said, I had to exhaust every door number three attempt in order to get here and become a hopeless alcoholic. And, you know, looking back on it, you know, there was plenty of times. You know, I can relate some experiences to all this. I think one of my favorite stories was when I was an angry kid and I didn't know what was right or wrong with me. You know, I watched my grandfather die of alcoholism, you know, before my eyes. I watched him drink until the bitter end, until he was dead, because he had to move in with us. And one of the things that my grandfather used to do, my mom used to make me go along with my grandfather, because she wanted him to control and enjoy his drinking. Well, he couldn't do that. But she would send me along with hopes that he wouldn't drink as much. So I'm like 12 years old, and I'm going to these Pennsylvania honky-tonk bars with my grandfather, you know, and I'm like walking in these places, and we're talking about places that don't have any windows, and, you know, it's noon, you know, and we're walking in, and I'm like, wait a minute, there's something wrong here. And it's noontime, and there's already people around the bar, and they're all sitting there, and they got this thing here going on, you know, looking up at me, and I'm like, whoa, you know. And I'll never forget Joanne Crosley. She was the first person I ever saw that had to actually get her hand up with the drink to get it down. And I had never seen anything like this before. And I was like, oh my God. I said, man, if I ever turn into somebody like this, somebody better kill me. You know, and I'll never forget that place. It was called the Milroy Hotel. And these people would sit around, and nobody was talking to nobody, you know. And they'd have a couple of drinks. And all of a sudden, somebody put a coin in the jukebox. All of a sudden, you hear some people start to laugh. And then by like 2 o'clock, everybody is having a good time. And I get to see this alcoholic transformation before my eyes. And I still wonder about that. I mean, all of a sudden, it's just like their lives turned upside down. They were okay with each other. They found the fellowship they desired. You know what I'm saying? I mean, these people were getting along. You know, it was like a sick home group. I mean, but these people would just stay together, you know, and they would travel in packs to bars, and I'd be like in tow, you know, like, just get me there alive. I just want to get home, you know, and after watching all this stuff go down, and seeing what problems my dad was getting into before he finally stopped drinking, you know, I had this thing like where I'm, you know, drinking's bad. Now, I had drank before. The first time I drank, I was 8 years old. And it was a keg party with my sisters. You know, they graduated high school, and my mom and dad got me an 8-pack of this stuff called Malt Duck, and they said, you can drink as much as you would like. And I drank alcoholically from 8 years old. Because I put that first one down, and I swigged that thing down, and for those of you that don't know what Malt Duck is, it's like a grape champagne beer-flavored type cooler thingy back before coolers were the end thing. And I drank that baby down, and I was sitting on the old picnic table doing what I always did as a kid, hanging out by myself, because I didn't want a part of anyone, because you guys just didn't understand me. And I'm sitting there, and I'm having a couple beers, and up drives this guy. He had the leather jacket on. He was driving up on the big motorcycle. He got off his motorcycle, and my sister and all our little girly friends were all standing over there on the side, and they were all giggling, looking at him. He comes up, and then all the guys on the other side of the party come up, and they're like his like little gophers. And I saw that, and I was like, that's what I want to be when I grow up. I want to be the center of attention. I want to be the one that has everybody's sense of approval. I want to be that guy. I want to be the man. And I tell you what, after a bunch of James Dean movies, you know, I tried my darndest to get there, man. I really did. But I have to face it, you know, sobriety also brings the realization that I'm just not that cool. So anyways, I see this, and I see that there's something out there for me to strive for, and it's not good grades, it's not a great job, I want to be the center of attention, I want to be the man, I want to be the one that everybody looks up to, and that's what I wanted to do. So at this point in time, later on in life, like I was talking about, I no longer like had this asphyxiation. Needless to say, when I was 8, I drank the blackout and I puked up, and I was like, I'll never drink it again. And I really didn't. You know, every once in a while I'd take a sip off the bottle or something like that, but I was like, always kind of like, I don't want to be like those people. Well, all my sisters come home, you know, from college, and I'm like 15 and a half. I'm the fat kid in school. I'm the one that has one friend. I eat like a box of Fruit Loops every day, and that's about what I'm sustaining myself on. And I'm sitting, you know, and my sisters all come home from college, and they're like, Merv, come on, we want to go out. You know, mom and dad aren't around. Why don't you come out with us? And I'm like, you know, okay, you know, and I go along. They're at the bar, and it's like, I mean, come on now. It's the early 80s, so, you know, Billy Idol's on 10. And everybody's getting down with them bad cells. And my sister, you know, the bartender comes up. My sister's place their drinks, and the bartender comes to me. I mean, I'm 15, and I don't bat an eye, and I say, I'd like a double Jim Beam and Coke, please. And that night was the night that I felt the effect of alcohol. That night was when I hit the bullseye. And that was the night I would chase for the rest of my life. You see, this kid that was so backwards and awkward, it couldn't relate to other people. I don't think I ever laughed wholeheartedly in my life until that night. And all of a sudden, after about 3 or 4 of those drinks, I'll tell you what, Merv came out to play. And I had a blast. I had so much fun. I felt like I had arrived. I have finally come here at last. I'm playing pool. I'm dancing. I'm doing all this stuff that I was always too scared and too shy to do. And I came out, and for the first time, I think I felt okay with who I was. And from that point on, the rest of my drinking career, all I wanted to do was recapture that night. And early on, I was able to recapture that all the time. You know, during high school, I mean, oh my God, I went from the fat kid with one friend, the ability to get alcohol, and what alcohol did for me. When I graduated, I was president of my class. I had the prom queen for the girlfriend. And, I mean, I was voted most likely to succeed. That's what alcohol does for a guy like me. See, alcohol is the solution to my spiritual illness. And I tried to use alcohol as much as possible to treat the spiritual disease. And I'll tell you what, it worked. I loved drinking. There is no doubt about it. I loved it. You know, because it did for me what I couldn't do for myself. It made me feel okay with who I was on the inside. It made me feel I was okay. And of course, you know, I mean, there's many, many stories of like, you know, what happened to me whenever I drank. You know, and the progression for alcohol for me was like, you know, I was able to have 6 beers, you know, and then I was able to have 8 beers and stop. And I was able to have 12 beers and stop. And then all of a sudden, I'm in trouble. I had 7 underage drinking fines before I turned 21. The week after I turned 21, I got a DUI. And I'm like, wait a minute, you know, some stuff, you know, I might need to kind of keep an eye on some of this stuff. But I'll tell you, what it did was it leaned me more towards drug use. because drugs were probably the best way that I could, you know, control and enjoy my drinking. Because whenever I get, like, overboard, I just smoke a bunch of weed just to, you know, just to kind of simmer me down a little bit. And if I really wanted to tie one on, I just take a bunch of speed, then I can go all night long. All night long, you know. Well, here comes Merv the Machine, ha ha, you know. What are you on? Can 30, you know, and, you know, like, he's still going, you know. I was the Energizer Bunny with, like, a, you know, a Bud Light in my hand, you know. I mean, it was crazy. But you know, those were the extremes that I had to go through, you know, and there was a bunch of horror stories. I mean, I had a bunch of DUIs and stuff like that. I did a bunch of stuff that I really didn't want to do, you know. It seemed like every time that I would draw a line in the sand, I was crossing it a week later. I don't want to do this. I just did this. I can't do this again. Next thing I know, I'm cheating on her again. I really loved her. I can't believe I did this, and then I'm doing it again. So I'm, like, scared to death to approach and even become a mature adult about it, so I just kick her to the curb and break her heart, and then I go off, and then I go to work, and all of a sudden I need more money to buy this, or I need more money to buy that. I'm not making enough money, so then I'm stealing from every place I bartended in. And, I mean, the list just keeps going and going. I mean, heck, I owned a bar at 21. I drank my way out of that in 9 months, you know. And, I mean, that was just the way my life was going. I moved up and down the East Coast because every time I would move to a new town, I would use and abuse you people. I would take you and I would lie to you and I would suck whatever you had, whether it was just your good energy, your money, or maybe it was your girlfriend. I would take whatever I had to take just to make me feel okay because these were outside resources I was trying to use to treat this spiritual illness of mine. And then all of a sudden I'd just turn around, I'd have no friends left, somebody would be looking for me, and I'd have to get out of town. And I would do that over and over and over again. You know, I mean, my God, every time I go on vacation, I'm like driving through a town, and I'm just like, I don't want to pour up for gas because he might be there, you know. I'm like, oh. But anyways, that's just the way it went. And things got tough. I was bartending at Ruby Tuesdays, and where I know Tim from, and I was bartending there, and my life was on the slide. I was no longer getting the full effect that alcohol was giving me. You know, I was no longer getting near the bullseye anymore. And you know, and I'm looking around, and I've seen my patterns. I know that I go through relationships very quickly, and I saw somebody there, and it was this new girl who was training there. And there was something different about her. She was nice. I didn't meet her in a bar. She had morals. She had a healthy lifestyle. She had, you know, aspirations of being a model citizen. And I said, these are the things I want. Maybe if I go out with her, maybe I might get those things too. So I asked her out. And we went to our first date, and I took my my bar crew to Smith Mountain Lake. And I got hit by a jet ski. I'll never forget, before I got hit by the jet ski, I can remember it as plain as day. She'd be out water skiing, and I mean, I'd be chugging Jaeger and drinking beers, and then as soon as she got off the jet ski and walk up, I'd pretend I had this warm beer. I was like, oh, this beer got warm, I think I need to pitch it out. Do you have any juice inside? You know, and I am petrified. I don't want her to know the truth about me, you know. But I get on this jet ski, and I fall off my jet ski, and a friend of mine hits me in the head. And I come to in the hospital 30 days later. And after, you know, some great doctors did a lot of plastic surgery, I come up out of my, I don't know if it was a coma or if I was just, I don't know what it was. But I come out of it, and she's sitting there. And I'm just like, and I just start crying. You know, and I see that my life is a shambles. And it was like one of those times that Clancy talks about where the armor's open, you know, where it's just like I'm exposed to the world. And I looked at her and I said, you know, and I'll tell you what, I meant it. I said, I never want to drink again. I have to stop drinking. This is it. I'm done. And she was just like, I just want you to get better. And I'll tell you, the second day I was out of the hospital, I was stealing liquor out of somebody's liquor cabinet. And I don't know what's wrong with me. Now I'm really scared. I don't know what's wrong with me now. And I know what's wrong with me. I can't stand how I feel sober. That's why I'm doomed to drink again. Sooner or later, you know, it only took 2 days out of the hospital. But I'll tell you what, if I don't get to a place where I'm okay with who I am without a drink in my system, I'm doomed to drink again. And the only thing that I've ever seen do that for me is the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that is it. And I've tried every different route. And but anyways, I get in a relationship with this woman, and we have our rocky times. I'm drinking a lot. I'm trying to stay out of trouble. I'm trying to stay away from her, the new cocktail waitress. I'm doing all these things to try and control and enjoy my thinking. That doesn't work either. And I'm doing all this stuff, and I don't know what's going on. And come on, we're in a material world, right? If I get the house, that'll fix me. That'll make me feel okay with who I am. I already got the wife. If I get early retirement, you know what? If I get, you know, some money under my belt, you know what? I'll be okay. I might be able to drink like a gentleman. And I went out to try and fix what was wrong with me with all these materialistic things. And I gave it my best shot. In fact, I accumulated a lot of it. You know, I had the house, and the resale value was triple. I had early retirement. I had a job in a law firm. I had all these things that I wanted, and there was still something wrong with me. You know, and I was in a lot of trouble at this point in time. And she had told me, if you drink again, I might have to leave. And now is the horror story of alcoholism. This is the worst part. The worst part for me is not drinking. The worst part for me is not drinking. And I'll tell you, off and on, I'm going to tell you what, just white knuckling 30 days. Just getting 30 days and just holding on and holding on. And without alcohol as a solution in my life, I'm going to tell you what, things get I get pretty mean. You know, I start telling you exactly what I think of you. And I start telling you exactly what's wrong with this situation and how you did it and how I'm going to make it right. And that's how I get. That's how I get. And I started burning every bridge. I started becoming very unemployable. I started losing my mind. And I swear to God, I thought for sure I was crazy. I thought for sure I was nuts. You know, and I guess I was right in a way. Because and slowly but surely, she'd get out of town, and I'd just wait for her to get out of town. I could not wait for her to leave so I could get a drink. And then pretty soon I get a little brave, and I start packing the trunk of my car up with some Listerine, some Zima, and some vodka. And I just sit there on the couch, not talking to nobody. It's 9 o'clock, she's going to go to bed soon, she needs to go to bed now. And I'd just be sitting there in my head, and then all of a sudden she'd go to bed. And I'm going to tell you what, the happiest time I had was that walk back to the car. Not actually drinking it, but walking back to the car, I felt all right because I knew what I was going to get. I was going to get the medicine for my soul. And I was going to go out there and I'd fill up that pitcher and I'd fill it halfway with Zima, halfway with vodka, and a little Listerine chaser just so nobody would smell anything. And I'd suck that thing down and I would be all right. But it wouldn't last long. It would last like 5-10 minutes. And I'd have to go get some more and suck that down. And it was no longer making me feel okay. And then all of a sudden I'm just not sleeping. And I want to drink around the clock. I want to so bad, but I'm just hanging on because I don't want to lose this woman. And I'm going to be quite honest about it. What I did was I started, edging her out of my life. You know, I drank and I had consequences by it, and that's why she left. But a lot of that stuff was premeditated because I figured alcohol outweighed it. The solution of alcohol outweighed it. I was going to edge her out till she could take no more. And she would leave, and then I'd be able to drink the way I wanted to drink. And that's what went down, you know. And I'm clear on that today. And that's the way it went down. And I edged her out of my life till finally she said, you know, you got to go. And I said, all right, I'm out of here. So I, you know, checked myself into a treatment program, and I just try and hang on. I try to do these treatments, and, you know, I get arrested. I end up in a rubber room again. I was fond of rubber rooms. I was in many of those. And things just weren't working out. You know, and I'm still thinking about my dad, who's happy and sober, and he just doesn't drink, and I don't get it. I drink like him. How come I can't stop? And I'm, like, losing it. I'm coming to AA. You know, I'm not feeling a part of. I don't, like, want to do what you guys are telling me to do. And there was nowhere else left. I had one friend left who moved me into his attic room. And I was in the gutter next time I drank. And I went, you know, and I just held on, but I went out and I got drunk. And for the second time the same week, I came to in a blackout in a jail cell. And I walked out of that jail cell, and I don't know. I don't know what was different. I walked to a bar, and I tried, or not a bar, but I walked to like a 7-Eleven-ish type place, and I got a 22-ounce of Bud Light. And maybe it was just God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself, but I couldn't keep that Bud Light down. And I'm dying behind this dumpster. And I said, you know, and I was thinking about it, you know, and I was like, well, there was that person in AA. And it was a person I heard speak, and I hated this person for years. The 6 years I was hanging around AA, they had their name stenciled in the big book. We're always talking about stairs and God and, you know, and all this stuff. They were, you know, and it was, and I hated that person because they were clear about themselves and they were okay with who they were, and I couldn't stand them. But I'll tell you what, whenever I walked to that meeting, I picked up that white chip from that dumpster. I called that person up. And thank God I was an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. It wasn't a member of Alcoholics Anonymous who just told me to, oh, just hang on. I'll meet you at a meeting on Monday. They didn't do that. See, this person was clear about what alcoholism was, and they were also very clear about, you know, how they are built. And they knew what I was for years watching me. And they were supposed to go to a conference that weekend, and they put that conference on the side, and they invited me in their home, and I sat down with them. And I told them, I said, look, I said, I'm just not an alcoholic. I said, you know, I'm a sex addict, I'm a drug addict, I'm blah, 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 blah. And they're like, hey, why don't we just sit down and talk? So we talked at this table and we broke out the doctor's opinion, and I'm like, oh boy, I'm going to be big book thumped. But we started reading out of the big book, and they started talking about their drinking, and they started talking about how they felt before they drank, what was happening when they were white knuckling it, and they just were drinking. And they started talking about the effect that alcohol would give them, the relief, and then also too about how they couldn't turn it off, and things started to pop in together. And then when we read the part about the heavy drinker, and I saw my dad there, and they told me, you're not your dad. You're an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. And I let them diagnose me. You know, I mean, everybody needs to come to their own conclusion. I understand that. But I was so out of shape, I let them diagnose me at that point. And I identified with them. And it was on much more than an intellectual level. It was like, whoa, yeah, I guess I am screwed. And I'm looking at this person, and this person, once again, happy and sober, has something going on that I don't understand. And looking back on it, I know what it was. They had a draw to them. Because not only were they happy and sober, they had a lot of material things too, but that's not what drew me to it. What drew me to it was that they had this, they are okay with who they are. They are okay with who they are. And the second thing was is that they had a purpose in their life. And that purpose was the primary purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's, I think, what drew me more than anything else. And whenever I saw these things, and I guess, you know what, maybe if I do these things, maybe I might get what they get. And that's all I needed, was a little bit of hope. And I just started doing these things, and I did them very imperfectly. I did the steps very imperfectly. The one thing, like I talked about whenever I first got here, was the one thing that I've done successfully pretty much. Throughout sobriety, I have said yes to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have said yes to a sponsor. And I had to dip around sponsor-wise. I had to get to, like, it took me 5 sponsors to get to the one I got right now. But I would always say yes to them. And there was many different instances where this would come into play. There were times early in sobriety where I didn't know if I was coming or going. You know, all of a sudden, oh my God, the realization of what I've done to all these people, what I did to my wife. You know, A, she wasn't coming back, and B, I just lost a lot of money. And all I have is a clothes and a knapsack. That's all I got. And I'm starting to get a little depressed, but my sponsor told me to get a coffee commitment. So I'm at this noon meeting, and I'm cleaning out my coffee pot, and I'm thinking about myself a whole heck of a lot. You know, about, man, just what happened in my life, why am I here, my God. And I'm going to tell you, tricky place, you know. Because we're not free of alcoholism. We're not free of the drink problem until somewhere between 5 and 11, you know. And so I was still in dangerous territory. But I was doing my coffee commitment. It was at a noon meeting. And somebody made an announcement. And they said, I'm going on a 12-step to call to the hospital. And I need a volunteer. And 80 people in the meeting, not a single volunteer. So he comes up and he taps me on the shoulder, you know, while I'm cleaning up the coffee pot after the meeting. He's just like, hey, man, I need somebody to come along. And I'm like, wait a minute, I'm 30 days sober guy. You know what I'm saying? I'm 30 days sober. You know, he's like, I don't care, you're coming. And the only thing that I thought about was, you got to say yes to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I don't know, I went along. And I'll tell you, whenever I went up to that hospital room, I mean, I was so self-absorbed with Merv and just my crappy life. And I'll tell you what, I went up there and I didn't have anything profound to say. I just stood there and I watched this guy talk to him about alcoholism. He'd look at me and all I'd chime in and be like, hey, it works, you know, and that's about all I had, you know, but I would chime in and I'd sit there and I was like watching this guy who's dying just like my grandfather, you know, and whenever I left that hospital room, I felt like $1 million. I felt okay. You know, I was like, wait a minute, you know what, I feel okay, and if by doing this gains me more of that. And it's not all about feeling okay, but at that point in time in my sobriety, it was. And I said, you betcha. And there was so many instances like that that you could just chalk up, or it's real easy to say no. Oh, I got something else I got to do. There's a lot of instances like that where I had followed through with the saying yes to Alcoholics Anonymous or saying yes to a sponsor when I didn't understand it, didn't think it was going to work, didn't know how it pertained to me. But now looking back, I see that it was the path I was supposed to be on. And, you know, and I would not be here today if I haven't done all that stuff. And I know that for a fact. And like I said, I went through, started getting a little bit active here and there. I'll tell you, you know, the fifth step, always a scary thing. There were so many things in my closet. A lot of it was the money. Didn't want to cough up the money because I knew what was coming. I've been around AA long enough and knew that I was going to have to pay some money back. So, and there was some other stuff. Some stuff that went down the night before the prom. I didn't want to talk about that. Also, some other horrendous activities that I've been involved with. And I didn't want to share none of those with nobody ever. And but I went into that fifth step, and I just said, it's life or death at this point. So I got to come clean, and I came clean, and I told them all about all that stuff. And that person pulled me aside, and they were very smart. They knew what I was thinking. They're like, Merv, this is going to be stuff that's going to be able to help another alcoholic. You need to remember this stuff. And I'm like, why do I want to remember this stuff? He's like, because when you go through the step process of Alcoholics Anonymous, what you're doing here is you're getting yourself ready to go out and to help God's kids. That's what it's all about. You know, if you think you're here to get closer to God, you're mistaken. Getting closer to God helps you do God's work. In fact, the phrase, faith without works is dead, appears more in the big book than any other. And that's my experience. Because I went chasing after God. You know what I'm saying? You know, I went chasing after God because I didn't want to go back and pay the money back. You know, so I had to find another venue, you know. So I go to like a lot of meetings and I talk about my relationship with God. But really it was because I didn't want you guys to know that I wasn't doing the deal. Because I did balk on paying the money back. I balked on a lot of amends. But you know what? I hung around here long enough, you know, that a lot of this stuff sank in. And slowly but surely I started paying that money back. You know, slowly but surely, God would put people on that I never thought I'd see again. They would be in my path, and I'd get to make the amends that I'd never wanted to make. And it's been a great process. You know, and that's the truth, like what they told me early on. I mean, you know, I've got a quick story, and I'll tell it. You know, this is somewhat recently, a couple of years ago. My son's in this day school. It's pre-kindergarten or something. It's like this father-son program, and we're hanging out, you know, and it's like 4 hours in this school, and so we're doing this, and I'm off that day. And meanwhile, you know, it's just like just a week, one of those weeks, you know, where you're just not really there, you know, and I'm like thinking about myself a lot. And, you know, and I'm noticing that it's fall time, and, you know, and I'm like looking at all these beautiful red trees and the maples and all this beautiful landscape, and mine and Randy's property has all these like ugly yellow trees in it. And I'm starting to think, I'm like, man, I need to knock some of these back. I need to chop down some of these ugly yellow trees, and maybe I can get some of these nice red ones in here, you know what I'm saying? And I'm thinking about this, and I'm bearing down onto my mind. In fact, I got a plan now, which is, you know, that's a red flag AA statement right there. But anyways, I have this plan, and I go through with it, and it's like we're at this school, and then all of a sudden I put some Grateful Dead, you know, in the CD player while I'm driving Jack home, and, you know, and we take the long way home. You know, a different way, a different angle home. And sure enough, he falls asleep, you know, and I'm driving along, and I'm looking at the beautiful landscape. It's picturesque, and then I'm like, well, I wish mine looked like that. And, you know, and I'm already thinking about revving up the chainsaw when I get home. And we come around this corner, and I look over, and there's like this, what looks like a bouquet of flowers out in the middle of all these horse pastures. And I'm like, wow, that's awesome. Man, I wish mine looked like that. And sure enough, as I approached the house, I took the left, and that bouquet of flowers was where my house was, you know, and I just had to laugh. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous does for a guy like me. Whenever I take a different angle, I take a different road, a different solution to the same old problem, something happens. As I get a new perspective, I get a new, perception of my own situation, my own personal truth. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous does on a grand scheme, but also on a daily basis for me. Because all that stuff that I would never want to share with another alcoholic is a pot of gold for a guy like me. Because I'm active. I like to go to meetings. I like to interact with other alcoholics. I talk to two or three different alcoholics every day on the phone. I'm not the guy who goes and hangs out with my normal posse. I'm the guy who looks for the guy standing by himself. And I talk to these guys. And more times than not, these guys are, you can just tell, I just did this. I did this to my wife. I just did this to my girlfriend. I just stole from work. And I'm like, hey man, you're not the only one. We have all done this stuff. And sometimes we continue to do it. But there's a way out. And AA is like the greatest spiritual recycling center on the face of the planet. We get to get all this stuff, all this horror show of our lives, the worst things you can think of, and all of a sudden by going through the steps, especially coughing it up and sharing it with another alcoholic and making restitution when possible, and then all of a sudden we're armed with experience that we can go out and make another person feel like they're not the only crappy person who's done this. They're not the only one. Their case is no longer different. You're just like me. Please come in and join us. Please get some hope. Because hope is, you know, I went to visit up in Maine, and they nailed it. You know, hope stands for hearing other people's experience. And I can't think of a better definition than that. My life today is full. My life today is also full of change. Recently got downsized from a meeting. Not from a meeting, but from a job. I had to go out and get a new job. Very uncomfortable. Before I would go out and act very immature, I would retaliate on my girlfriend, do stuff like this. But this time around, I don't know how it happened, but it was just like a bump in the road. And that's kind of like new for a guy like me, because generally, whenever there's a change about, man, it's everybody hold on, MERS going through change, duck and cover, and that's the way it's always been, you know. But there has been a lot of change, and I'll tell you, you know, the benefits of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because, you know, I'm one of those guys, you know, that firmly believes that AA, you know, there's a lot of people in here who show me what to do, and there's a lot of people in here who show me what not to do. And the thing is most of the people that helped me get sober are drunk now. Most of them are. Well, a few of them are dead. And I got to watch it, and it wasn't pleasant. In fact, I got a guy right now that I'm trying to sponsor, and I'm watching him drink himself to death. And it's tough, but I'm going to tell you, it's always the same. They seem to come in and they seem to get attached to Alcoholics Anonymous, but they never want to follow through with some action or another. They're holding on to something. And then what happens is they get so uncomfortable in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous because inside they just still don't feel a part of that, all of a sudden they put this up. And all of a sudden 5 meetings turns to 4. 4 meetings turns to 3. Then you're down to 2. And then all of a sudden, where'd Joe go? Where's Joe? I haven't seen Joe in a month. And then I'm like, you know, watching a football game in a local bar, and I see Joe. Joe's like trying to hide his Bud Light in his pocket because he sees me across the room. And that was just 2 days ago, you know. And that's just the way it goes, you know. And, you know, so for me, being consistent in meetings is a big deal. For me, being honest with another alcoholic is a big deal, too. And I got to keep doing that. And I know I'm kind of babbling at this point. I'll just kind of end up with this. You know, lots of change. Life is full. Does not mean I'm perfect. Billy said earlier that, you know, that we do talk a lot. And Billy's one of those people that helped talk me down off of a couple of ledges in my lifetime. 2 quick stories. First story is this. I just got done putting on a day conference. Spiritual giant. And I'm feeling good. You know, it was a great time. We had a good time at this day conference. And I'm going to tell you, I still can get affected by fear. Fear, when you put me in the wrong place at the wrong time, I'm still liable to react badly to life. And I'll tell you what, I can pour as much as AA as I want on that, but I'm still going to, sometimes that's still going to happen to a guy like me. Because I'm still young. I'm only 8 years sober. And, you know, and I don't know, I got a phone call from my girlfriend. She calls me up, and what I heard her say was not what she said. What I heard her say was, your son just killed a dog. That's not what she said. What she really said was, your son saw the dog die. But I was so freaked out that I heard her say, my son killed the dog. And I'm on my way home, and I'm starting to get a little goofy. And then I'm on my way home, and I'm like, I'm going to pay somebody. Somebody's going to get it when I get there. And I know myself because I'm the kid who punches holes in the cinder blocks. And I'm getting scared. But I'm really mad. And I called a friend up in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I told him what was going on. And I'm going to tell you what. Just that. Hearing, I don't know, prayer was mixed in there. But I'm going to tell you what. I need the living example of a power greater than myself sometimes in my life, just as much as the conscious awareness of God. And he just said, you're not the only one. I've gone through things like this. This is what you need to do. Think about another alcoholic. You need to go home and, it's not what you're taking from the party no more, Merv. What are you bringing? What are you bringing to this party? Are you going to practice these principles? Kindness, love? Are you going to give? Or are you going to take? What's the deal? And it was a little firm from what I recall, but that's how it had to be brought to my attention. And I went home. And I was able to be a dad, an understanding dad, whose kid just watched a dog collapse and have a seizure and die. I got to go home, girlfriend's, whose dog, she loved this animal for 7 years, and be a giving person. Help her get that dog loaded up and get it down to get cremated. As opposed to going home and enforcing my will out of fear. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous can do for me today. The other story is this. If you have dumped something bad, don't worry about it. You're in the world's greatest recycling center. In sobriety, I was fearful about money. I had a kid on the way. I didn't know what I was going to do. I was scared to death. And I was working at this Greek diner, which, turned out to be the greatest job ever. Once again, great thing about AA, look back, greatest job ever. When you're in it, I hate it. But I'll tell you, I was stealing. And it wasn't much. I deserved it because I wasn't being treated right. So I'd steal like a dessert every day, baklava. I would always steal a baklava, and because I deserved it because they weren't treating me right. You know what I'm saying? I deserved this because the boss is a jerk. And I would take all these things until I became so uncomfortable with where I was at. I went to my sponsor and I finally had to cough it up. And he's like, well, you got to go back and make that right. And I'm like, man, I might lose my job. And he's like, well, talk it over with your girlfriend. My girlfriend's like, no, you need to make that right. Because she's on board with AA too. So I went back and I made that right. And it became something that I got to joke about in meetings. Because I paid it back. I even went back and sold again and paid it back again. Because I'm a slow learner in AA. And but I went back and it became one of those things like that. I would always tell this story in meetings. And Merv's going to tell the baklava story again. And it would always get the joke or the laugh. What was it, about 6 months ago, this guy comes up and taps me on the shoulder. Because I just told the baklava story. He's just like, Merv, in case you haven't noticed, over the last 5 years, I'm the only guy in the room that's not laughing at your baklava jokes. He's just like, I just want to tell you something. I've been stealing from work. And I understand. I've been thinking that I've been taken advantage of. And you know what? I want to go back and pay that money back. See, if we mess up and we fall down and we fail on the principles, in Alcoholics Anonymous, if you're active here and you're in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, once again, it becomes a useful thing. How do I know that I wasn't supposed to be able to steal that baklava? Well, I don't know. But I took it through the process and I paid it back and I shared about it freely. And now another person has that weight off their shoulders. Because I want to tell you, dishonesty will get you out of here just as fast as anything else. And is able to come clean with that. And, that's good stuff. And that's not me. That's the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the power of God that I have come to, barely know through the steps and the grace of the 12 steps of our program. Like I said, I'm just happy to be here. I it's all about progress for me. It's not about perfection. And I think I'm done. So thanks a lot for having me.